A lot of investors miss out on that point. They think, okay, it's a hot deal. I got to close fast.
Right.
Only way to get it is I have to buy it cash. So they make an offer to the seller to buy cash so they can get the deal.
Yep.
And that's sometimes what you have to do in order to avoid missing out on that deal, on that opportunity. Mm-hmm. But the danger in doing that is now when you go to refinance it, you're going to miss out on 5-10%
right.
of that refinancing, you know, capability.
Are you tired of trying to keep ahead in the rat race, only to have so much of your hard-earned money going to the tax collector? Equity doesn't pay the bills. Retirement savings don't pay you now, and there are only 24 hours in a day to work. The only solution is passive income that pays you 24/7 now, not 40 years from now. From vetted investment opportunities to tax saving strategies, let John guide you through all the confusion and take control of your financial life in pursuit of financial freedom. So sit back, relax, and welcome to the Wealth and Freedom Nexus.
All right, and welcome back to another great episode, episode 58 of the Wealth and Freedom Nexus podcast, coming to you on November 23rd, 2022. Now, this will be a little shorter interview and introduction, as I know many of you are gearing up for Turkey Day, Thanksgiving, and time with friends, family, food, and probably football. I'm not one to watch football games, but I know many people out there are big fans, whether it's the Vikings or Packers or heck, I don't even know who's getting towards the Super Bowl or, you know, in the lead at this point. So I'm not much of a sports fan, but to all those out there, hope your team that you're rooting for wins. Now, I do have a returning guest on this show, and I wanted to cover three specific topics. Kind of wanted to nail them all in one podcast episode versus breaking them up into three individual ones. The first topic we will cover is the 1% rule dead? If you have been following real estate investing for any amount of time or been involved in real estate investing, you've probably heard the 1% rule. Generally speaking, this is if it's a $100,000 house, purchase price that it should rent for $1,000, dividing $1,000 into $100,000 gets you 1%. That was kind of the litmus test or quick gauge, so to speak, to measure if an investment property was worth pursuing, just to, you know, quick little envelope math. And usually if it hit that rule, then it was worthwhile pursuing more, knowing that there was enough of a spread with the rent that it would cover, you know, financing, mortgage, interest, taxes, and insurance and HOA fees if they're applicable. As we've seen with the market in the last, definitely the last 2 years, I would say even the last 3 to 4, starting to see that 1% kind of creep down to like 0.9%, 0.8, 0.7. I've seen as old as 0.4, and it's just as the prices of the real estate are just going higher and higher with appreciation, supply and demand. Obviously, we've seen a just huge lack of supply, the fewest number of homes built from 2010 to 2020 since the 1930s, which we had that great recession going on at that time. And obviously the U.S. population has increased pretty dramatically since then. So just with all those variables, kind of wanted to discuss with this week's guest, is the 1% rule dead? Do we need to just flat out forget about it? Are there new rules that we should be looking at or other calculations we as investors should be looking at in order to pursue a rental property or investment property that makes financial sense? Now, the second topic I want to bring up is, are there ways to passively invest? And what are some other ways to invest that, you know, you don't have to be a landlord and don't even have to be a property owner? Maybe you just want to be passively investing, maybe get some monthly cash flow. Don't have to be accredited, but especially if you have a self-directed retirement account and maybe you've taken a beating with the stock market, the Dow, the S&P, NASDAQ, all down for 2022. Who knows what this is going to lead into a 2023? And the short answer is yes, there are alternative options for investing. I myself have invested in this with my self-directed retirement account through special Specialized Trust. You can catch my interview with that with Amanda back in episode 7, I believe it was. Otherwise, just Google Specialized Trust or look at search that through your podcast platform of choice. But again, this is another, shall we say, vetted investment. Again, I'm not giving investment advice, but this is an investment opportunity that I myself have partaken in, been very satisfied with, and saw it from beginning to end. So put up the money to invest, collected the interest, and cashed out at the end. And, you know, no qualms about it. Worked out very well. So again, might not be for everyone, but definitely want to give another option out there for anyone wanting to passively invest in real estate and or get some better returns in the retirement accounts or self-directed accounts that are outside the volatile stock market. And then finally, another another option that my guest brings are additional mortgage and financing options. Now, if you've joined me from the beginning, I brought on Chaley Ridge of Ridge Lending, as well as Timothy Hero of Hero Lending. And we've discussed many times, there's the conventional financing, as well as what's called non-QM or non-conventional financing. Many options that you can do directly in an LLC. A lot less paperwork to turn in. It is geared more towards what do the numbers of the property look like, and do those numbers carry a mortgage on the property? Not looking so much at the individual, you know, what's the individual's credit score? What's their W-2 job? What's their debt to income ratio? What's their current debts? What their current debts outstanding, et cetera, et cetera. And just as another option that's available to real estate investors like myself, and might even be a good option for those out there that are either maxed out on their 10 golden tickets that we talked about in episodes 20 and 22, or maybe just want to go a different route for financing. Maybe they're self-employed. Maybe they have extremely variable income and don't qualify, or maybe even they just don't have the best of credit scores. You know, sometimes things happen. I've talked to people that sometimes have, you know, sub 600 and even around a 500 credit score that just won't meet the guidelines of a traditional bank. And if you have, obviously, higher the credit score, the better, but don't necessarily have to have a pristine credit score and credit history in order to get these type of loans. So those are the three topics that we'll be discussing today with guest Marco Santarelli, who returns again from Nerada Real Estate. We will get into my interview with Marco after a word from this week's sponsors.
Buying rental homes are one thing, but buying older homes could bring more headaches for a new real estate investor. Outdated wiring, cracking foundations, and hazardous materials like asbestos are not things a beginning investor should have to deal with nor worry about. Why not start with a brand new construction home in one of the fastest growing areas in the U.S., Central Florida? Wagner Nolasco and his team, Build to Rent, have over 3,000 homes in various stages of development and work only with real estate investors. Their new homes feature tenant resilient amenities like vinyl floor plank, lower insurance premiums than older homes, and possibly even very low property taxes for the first year or two. To find out more and learn how this is all possible, go to buildtorentdirect.com or text 407-927-5074. That's build the number 2 rentdirect.com. Marco, thanks for coming back on the show.
John, my pleasure. It's always an honor to be on your show. So thank you very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And yeah, thanks for coming on again. Glad we were able to reconnect. Now, as I kind of alluded to before on the intro, and I don't know, I've probably heard this ad nauseum since about 2017 or probably even 2014 when I first got into real estate investing. The 1% rule, you know, guideline, it's $100,000 property should rent for $1,000 a month, hence the 1% rule. You just divide that into the purchase price. As we've seen this, shall we say, crazy real estate market nationwide with prices just skyrocketing and rents not keeping up, I've been seeing more like, you know, 0.9, 0.8. Personally, my dead stop is 0.7, but I've seen as low as 0.4. I won't name names of the provider I saw of that. So maybe just high level. I mean, you operate in several MSAs, you know, over a dozen states throughout the United States. Is the 1% rule when it comes to investing dead, or should that just not even be an issue anymore?
Yeah, John, that's a really good question. You actually summarized it pretty well.
Okay.
It is not dead.
Okay.
The 1% rule was always meant to be a rule of thumb. It's a target. Okay. It's not an absolute. And so years ago, let's call it 5, 6, 7 years ago, when we have a more balanced market, where we're not in an extreme buyer or seller's market, the 1% rule works really well. You find it often. But again, we have to make something very, very clear here. You have to look at the context of where you're measuring this 1% rule,
okay,
because it's very much market specific, but more importantly, okay, it's neighborhood specific. And I'll explain that here in a second. So first of all, the 1% rule is basically what you just said. I use the $100,000 property as an example. If you have $100,000 property and it rents for $1,000 a month, that would be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
That would give you a 1%, 1,000 divided into 100,000. Now, that was the target for most investors most of the time in the years past.
Okay.
Over the last 3 years or more, that 1% rule started to fade away. It was becoming harder and harder to find in the same neighborhoods, in the same markets. Okay. Again, let's not change the context. Keeping all the variables constant, that 1% rule started to fade. It became 0.9%, 0.8%. And, you know, I do agree the 0.7 is around my floor.
Okay.
If you look at places, expensive markets like coastal California and Washington, D.C., Denver, a lot of these markets, again, all else being equal, have become overpriced, in some cases frothy or bubble markets. So in coastal markets, like where I live, we haven't seen a 1% rule since probably 1999.
Wow.
That long ago. And so what that means is that what we see here is 0.4% on average. Sometimes 0.3, 0.4, maybe 0.5. As you work your way inland, it goes up a little higher. But it's hard to break that 0.7, even 0.6.
Mm-hmm.
All that tells you is this. You're in a pricey market where property values far exceed the rental income or the rental rates of those same properties, and you just can't achieve those numbers. Mm-hmm. That means your cap rates are going to be low. That means your cash-on-cash returns are going to be low. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to see strong appreciation, because we've had strong appreciation gains over the last number of years when we've had low rent to price ratios, which is what that 1% rule is, a rent to price mm-hmm. ratio. So it doesn't mean that it's a bad deal. It's just not going to be a good cash flow deal, or it's not going to be a good deal in terms of your cash on cash return, your immediate upfront returns. So now how do you increase that 1%? You can do one of two things. Be what we preach all the time. Be market agnostic. Don't be mm-hmm. married to market. Just go and find yourself another market where the numbers work out better, make more sense, like the Midwest, pockets mm-hmm. of the Northeast, areas in the South and Southeast. That's where we operate in 25 markets in those areas, because you can get close to that 1% rule.
Okay.
The other way to achieve that is within the same market, or not, but within the same markets, but moving to different neighborhoods. Now there's a danger here. I can move from an A class neighborhood to a B class neighborhood and get a good deal, do well, and be successful in real estate. But it becomes riskier and more concerning when you drop from B class neighborhoods into C class neighborhoods mm-hmm. and hopefully not dropping into D class neighborhoods.
Right.
When you go down from, you know, A minus, B plus, B minus, C plus, etc., the numbers start to work more favorably as far as that rent to price ratio. So your RV ratio goes up, you get closer to that 1% rule. But what's the cost of doing that? What's the risk? You're moving into sketchier areas with, you know, a demographic of tenants that might not be suitable for you or meet the investment criteria that you have. And so now you're going to have more tenant turnover, more tenant problems, mm-hmm. more collection issues, you know, people that are more transient, maybe don't care about their credit. They're going to move more, you know, maybe yeah. manage your property. So you don't want to downgrade your investment criteria in order to get a higher rent to price ratio.
Okay.
So the 1% rule is not dead. It's just less common, especially when you're looking at the same neighborhoods that you were looking at 5 years, 7 years ago. They were 1% then. They might be 0.8, maybe 0.7 today. So that's a long answer to your question, but I think you have to take a look at markets, neighborhoods, the quality of the neighborhood, and how markets change to just talk about the 1% rule.
Sure. No, that makes sense. And you were kind of mentioning the sketchier neighborhoods. I mean, I've talked to, you know, friends and associates and, you know, various groups where on paper, they might have a great 1%, 1.2% rent to value ratio. But if you have a, you know, 80% occupancy rate versus a 95% occupancy rate on paper, that's going to change a little bit. I know you had mentioned too, with the market specific and, you know, even neighborhood specific, I kind of think of, I don't know, I'll just throw out Texas, where you might need a higher rent to value ratio just because typically their property taxes are higher. Whereas Florida, especially, you know, if it's a new build, a lot of times the property taxes are a little bit lower in Florida or another market I like in Alabama. And if it's a new build, typically the property insurance is going to be cheaper than if you're buying a, you know, 1900 Rambler or something that has, I don't know, asbestos tiles or a roof that's almost caving in. So there's definitely a lot of other variables to look in there, like you mentioned. So,
but for sure. Yeah.
Moving on, Marco. Now, I myself have been through, you know, either a mortgage origination or even a refinance situation. Probably should have counted before this recording, but I'm going to guess at least a dozen times. And sometimes just with, you know, tax returns, pay stubs, bank statements, you know, paperwork, I think a colonoscopy would be more enjoyable than going through the underwriting process. But Marco, you and your company, you've actually expanded outside just rental real estate, and you actually offer mortgages for, I believe, specifically investors. But can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So really, just to take a step back to define, you know, the types of mortgages out there, there's many different kinds, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about flavors as much as I'm talking about types. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand that there are two basic types. There's conventional financing, non-conventional financing.
Yeah.
Sometimes the non-conventional is referred to as non-QM financing, mm-hmm. Which I believe refers to as qualified mortgage. So most people are familiar with conventional, which is your Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and even to some degree, you know, you could drop FHA loans into that. But sure. It's your mortgage financing for those who are well qualified and are getting their mortgage funding through a GSE, a government-sponsored entity, which is like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. They're not actually government bodies, but they are sponsored and supported by the federal government. They're standalone entities. They buy mortgage-backed securities on the you know, the publicly traded stock exchange, like in the public markets. And so what they do is they help support the mortgage market by allowing lenders to lend money to borrowers. Those lenders package those loans together into bundles, and then they sell it onto the secondary market, and then institutions and investors invest in those for that yield that's coming off of those mortgages every month, you know, by homeowners and investors paying their monthly mortgage payments. So that's the conventional loan market. It's a very liquid market. It's a big market, and it's traded every trading business day. The non-QM side is where we put our focus. And the reason is there's so many lenders out there. Everybody, from, you know, major banks like Wells Fargo down to secondary banks that, you know, lend nationwide, to more boutique regional and local lenders. I didn't want to be in the same space. It's highly, highly competitive. I could, but there's a lot of regulation and licensing involved, and I didn't want the brain damage. But I found in the last 18, almost 19 years of selling turnkey investment real estate through our company at Norada Real Estate Investments, we found that a lot of investors are in one or two categories. Well, three categories. One, they qualify for conventional financing, but then they become this number two person, which means that they've capped out how many conventional loans they can get, because there's a limit, and let's call it 10 per social security number or 10 per person. At that point, you can't get any more conventional loans. You have to now go to non-conventional sources. And then there's this third category, which is really my second category. And those are borrowers that either have less than stellar credit, or they're foreign national buyers, or they are, they're not citizens. They may be residents, or maybe they're not residents, or they may be challenged in a way where they have too many properties, or the property doesn't qualify for conventional financing, or they have maybe a black mark on their credit, which doesn't completely disqualify them from mortgage financing, but makes it very difficult for them to get conventional financing. So there's this area of people where they are qualified and they are responsible, and they can get they can get mortgage financing, but it's not conventional. Okay. That's where the non-QM financing comes in, and there are all kinds of products in this category. Just like you have all kinds of flavors of conventional financing, you have all kinds of flavors of non-conventional financing, okay, such as your 30-year fixed rate, your 15-year fixed rate, your adjustable rate mortgages. You know, that could be 3, 5, 7, 10-year adjustable rate mortgages. You've got interest-only loans. I mean, you've got all kinds of options. And the qualification criteria is not as stringent, partly because the underwriting for that loan is not just about you, it's also about the property. Is it in the right market, the right location? Is it in the right condition? I mean, if it checks the boxes, they're going to say, yeah, we love the asset, and it's going to be make good collateral for the loan. Okay. So we like the property, and we like you. You're not perfect, but you know, you qualify. Like, you've got a credit score that's over 620.
Okay.
Which sounds low today, but you know, you're over 620, but the higher credit score, the better your interest rate.
Gotcha.
So that's a long answer to your question, but essentially that's the area that we focus on is that non-QM financing for everybody that either capped out on conventional financing or don't qualify for conventional financing.
Gotcha. And now, as I understand it, I've heard this call a couple of different things, but when it's, shall we say, conventional financing is concentrating on you as the individual, you know, what's your credit score, what's your debt to income ratio, what's your credit reports, etc. I believe on the non-QM side, and maybe you can speak to this a little, it's called the debt service coverage ratio, where does the gross rents cover, you know, the principal, interest, taxes, mortgage, or excuse me, taxes, insurance, and if applicable, HOA fees, and then some. I've seen some lenders as low as, you know, one DSCR, where, okay, the rent covers the obligations and nothing else. So hopefully nothing breaks. But is there a higher threshold that you have where it has to be like a 1.1 or 1.2 debt service coverage ratio, or how does that work?
Most lenders, I believe, in this space are somewhere around 1.1 to 1.2 DSCR, debt service coverage ratio, which means they want to see 10 to 20% more from 10 to 20% more from the cash flow of that property.
Sure.
Or the net operating income, actually, to cover the debt service.
Okay.
So that means at the end of the day, after the debt service is covered from the net operating income of the property, you've got 10 to 20% left over, which is essentially your net, your bottom line cash flow.
Sure.
So that's a comfortable rate, a comfortable level for lenders to lend on. Now, some very aggressive lenders will drop it down to one. They'll go down or one even, which means that it's on par. There's no cash flow above or below. That doesn't happen very often, but some will aggressively do that. Now, you're paying a higher, much higher interest rate for that, and you have a lower loan to value. Like, you might only get 70% loan to value. You're not going to get 75-80% or more. So there's levers in lending. You know, you can play with the lever up and down on the loan to value, you know, 70-75-80-85, maybe 90% loan to value.
Okay.
You can play out with the lever, that's the interest rate. You know, the higher the perceived risk by the lender, the higher that interest rate will be. Those are usually the two biggest levers that lenders will play with.
Okay. Makes sense. So, all right. And now you had mentioned this, obviously, just kind of in the loan to value and with the mortgages that you offer, is this solely for, I obviously mentioned there's no cap. So if an investor wants to come and, you know, they have a huge surplus, they want to do 20% down payment on 20 properties and get leverage for the rest. But could this also play into if they want to do cash out refinances, like we've seen with huge equity builds in the last, you know, 2-3 years, and maybe an investor sitting on, you know, just pick a number, 50,000 equity and property down in Alabama, could they come to your company and say, hey, I want to do a, I'm just throwing out a 75% loan to value cash out refi of a 30-year fixed?
Yeah, you actually hit on two really good points that I didn't even think about before. a lot of this is outlined, not in great detail, but definitely broken down into the different types of mortgage financing, because we'll even do fix and flip loans. We'll do long-term, short-term, short-term rentals, you know, where you don't have a traditional tenant. You're renting that by the night. Bridge loan financing. We have all these loan programs, and they're on our website at noradafunding.com.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it's actually a new website. We just launched it, rebuilt it and relaunched it less than 4 weeks ago. So at noradafunding.com, there's a page on there which breaks down the different loan programs. It doesn't give you interest rates because they change like by the day.
Yep, exactly.
So, but suffice to say, it's competitive with conventional financing. It's not going to be on par with. However, side note, you can prepay or buy down your rate to make to lower it, which in many cases, in fact, maybe in most cases, is worth doing, because that that amount you pay up front, which is probably in the few thousands of dollars. Yes, it's a chunk of change, but in the grand scheme of things, if you look at how much you're saving in interest by lowering your rate over the course of 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 10 years, you're going to make that up, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100 times. So it's worth buying down the rate if you're going to keep the loan long term.
Sure.
But you mentioned two types of loans, cash out refi.
Yeah.
So that's doable. And then one that you, I don't know if you meant to mention, but you reminded me of is what I'll call a portfolio loan of sorts.
Oh, sure. Yep.
So the cash out refi is doable if you have enough equity in the property. The loan to value, in other words, how much of that property you can finance with a cash out refi, is always going to be lower than a new money purchase loan. So if you're doing a new money purchase loan, you might be able to do 80% of that property loan to value.
Okay.
But when you do a cash out refi, it's usually less by about 5 to 10%. So your max will be 75, maybe 70. So if you have a choice, you're better off financing it with the purchase rather than buying cash and then refinancing it later,
because
you won't get the higher LTV by refinancing it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And a lot of investors miss out on that point. They think, okay, it's a hot deal. I got to close fast.
Right.
Only way to get it is I have to buy it cash. So they make an offer to the seller to buy cash so they can get the deal.
Yep.
And that's sometimes what you have to do in order to avoid missing out on that deal, on that opportunity. Mm-hmm. But the danger in doing that is now when you go to refinance it, you're going to miss out on 5 to 10%.
Right.
Of that refinancing, you know, capability. Not always.
Right.
But often.
Yep. Although interesting side note, since you mentioned that, I know still at the time of this recording, you know, the Colorado market is red hot and there were just a ton of cash buyers. And I was reading that one of the reasons behind that is a lot of essentially drug dealers, where, you know, cannabis is legal now in Colorado, but it's still illegal on the federal level, so they can't qualify for a lot of federal loans. They'll use their hordes of cash from growing cannabis. They buy a property. They don't care what the price is. It's like, hey, I'll just throw some cash. Then they refinance the money out to deploy elsewhere, and then they can, you know, legitimately put on their, you know, conventional financing application, hey, I am a real estate investor versus a, you know, cannabis dealer that is still illegal by federal standards. But that might be another side topic, but just made me think of that when you mentioned why are some people buying cash and missing out on those opportunities. So
just to close the loop, because I don't want your listeners to be waiting for the portfolio financing. I'll just
No,
you're fine. Doing it for the benefit of your audience.
This week's podcast is brought to you by Spartan Invest. Spartan currently manages hundreds of turnkey properties across Alabama and Tennessee, and is where I personally bought my first out-of-state turnkey property. In fact, I have two properties with them now, and both tenants just renewed for another 2 years. That should tell you the quality of their team and their due diligence. If you are a first-time investor or are looking to expand your real estate portfolio, check out SpartanInvest.com.
So what I'll call a portfolio loan, it's not technically called a portfolio loan, but sometimes, and I've done this actually recently with five of my own properties up in Wisconsin.
Oh,
you can get what I refer to loosely as a blanket mortgage. But it's essentially one mortgage that covers more than one property.
Okay.
So I refinanced five properties that I had bought and renovated in Wisconsin. I put them together into one loan. So I have one mortgage loan through Norada Funding, our lending arm. So I have one mortgage that covers the five properties, which is a beautiful thing, because if you're buying two or more properties at the same time and you want to package the financing together, you can actually finance two or more properties together under one loan and have that make that purchase or the refinance on multiple properties.
Okay.
And this is good for somebody who already owns properties that wants to do a refinance on two or more.
Sure.
Whether they're pulling cash out or not, or if you're renovating property and you own that property or properties and you want to put them together and you intend to keep them long term, it just simplifies things. It's one close, one transaction, mm-hmm. one loan, one set of closing costs, and you can lock in a rate for those multiple properties. And sometimes it just makes more financial sense to do that. So just think about, don't always think about one loan per property. You can think about mm-hmm. one loan per X number of properties.
Gotcha.
And as long as those properties check the box, you know, then it makes sense. And here's another reason to do it. Sometimes many lenders will not give you a mortgage loan that's under a certain dollar amount. Like most lenders don't want to finance properties under $100,000.
Right.
They don't want those smaller loans. So if they won't touch it, they won't do it, and you can't get a loan, then you might want to consider buying two or three or four, you know, of these $80,000 properties. I'm not saying go out and do that. But that was my situation. All my properties were in Wisconsin had a market value of $100,000 on average or less. Okay. So I didn't break the $100,000 mark on those properties, but together I had about $500,000 worth of properties that I refinanced into one loan, and that qualified me because it was one bigger loan that they were happy to do.
Okay. Interesting.
When I say they, I mean our company, Norada Funding, but I was an outside borrower, you know, it's not like it still has to go through underwriting
and right.
like everybody else.
So, okay. And I'm just kind of thinking out loud, like you mentioned before, where a lot of investors are tapped, you know, at 10 conventional or conventional loans, 20 if they're married, filing jointly and qualify. If, you know, maybe the numbers work, the interest rates are lower in conventional financing. Well, you know, just throwing out numbers, if you have 10 rental properties, you're capped out. Maybe you do a portfolio loan refinance. So on your personal report, those five go off. Now you have five golden tickets, if you will. Now you can start building up your property again with 30-year fixed conventional financing for mm-hmm. five other properties. So just, you know, maybe another strategy way.
Yeah, yeah. That you bring up a really good point. Someone who's tapped out at 10 conventional loans, this is a great way to start freeing up those slots on their credit mm-hmm. report so they can go out and get a conventional financing. So the question is, when do you do that? When should you do that? The best time to do that is when you need to free up slots for larger loans.
Like sure.
if you wouldn't want to do that if you have a mortgage for $100,000. But if you're looking to purchase something that is going to be a much larger loan amount, or you're looking at purchasing a duplex, triplex, fourplex, something that's a bigger loan, that's when you want to do that. Why? Because the conventional financing is going to give you the best terms, like the best mm-hmm. rate and term. And you want that on the larger loan amounts because it's going to be the lowest amount of payments.
Okay.
So in other words, another way of saying all this is save your conventional financing for the larger loans and the larger properties. Mm-hmm. Use the non-QM financing, like what we do at Norada Funding, for your smaller mortgage purchases.
Makes sense. So, okay. And then I think at least last time I checked too, and maybe kind of like you allude to the bigger properties, you know, say a fourplex for $500,000. I believe still for slots 1 through 6 on conventional, you can put 20% down. Once you hit 7 to 10, then Freddie Fannie says, no, you have to put 25% down. Well, that extra 5%, if you're right on the line and want to get a $500,000 fourplex, well, that can be a difference of 25 grand right there. Heck, that might be a down payment somewhere else on a single property.
Yeah, what you said is exactly true. However, you have to add another 5% if it's not a single family home. So what you said is true for single family. When you get to duplex, triplex, fourplex, you're taking another 5% hit. So rather than 20% down, it's actually 25% down as a minimum.
Ah, okay. Well, I just
and then over that 4 to 6 cap, it's now 30% down.
Gotcha. So still 5% savings, but a 5% bump because it's not a single family. Got it. So okay. Sounds good. Well, as we're getting close to the end here, Marco, and one other thing I wanted to touch base on, and you know, maybe some of my listeners are like, well, gosh, I'd really like to buy a, you know, rental property, but I just don't have the funds for it. Or maybe they've, you know, listened to one of my previous podcasts of self-directing retirement accounts, and maybe they're like, well, I'd like to invest in real estate, but I kind of want to be hands-off, no, you know, tenants, toilets, termites, et cetera. Could you speak to a little bit with your kind of your investment arm with the promissory notes?
Yeah, for sure. Kind of an interesting departure from, you know, talking about real estate, but you make a really, really good point. So there's really, you know, we have multiple companies, but we have two types of investment offerings. We have turnkey real estate investments, and then we have promissory notes, which are for just very straightforward, simple, predictable monthly income. It's about the most simple and passive investment you can make, because it's mm-hmm. essentially just a loan agreement, if you want to define what, you know, a promissory note is. So we talk to investors like every day, and some people make the same point you just did. You know, they say, well, look, you know, I have enough real estate, or I'm pumping the brakes on my real estate investing because I just don't know where we're headed for the next 2-3 years. You know, I don't know where the economy is going to be, if we're going to be in, you know, more than one recession, if interest rates are going to continue to go up. I mean, you just, you know, name it. There's a long list of reasons why people are just taking a pause. And I totally get it. I understand. So, but the most dangerous thing these people do, and what they shouldn't do, and most people don't even recognize that they do it, and this will resonate with you, I'm sure, John, is they don't want to sit on a large pile of cash. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be cash rich in an environment like we have today, because we are in an inflationary environment. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you're losing purchasing power of that cash savings you have stashed away, regardless of where it is, whether it's in a self-directed account or not. So if our inflation rate is, you know, between 10 and 15%, I'm talking real inflation, not nominal,
shadow stats, headline. Correct.
Yeah, totally. Like if we're losing 10 to 15% per year in purchasing power, why are you sitting on, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, $1 million of cash? You're going to lose that 15% by in 12 months. So what you need to do is protect it and ideally make more than the real rate of inflation. So how do you do that? You can do that in real estate, but if you're pumping the brakes on real estate, the point is where do you go? What do you turn to? A lot of people are now skittish about, you know, being in the equities market, like the stock market. In fact, you know, it's been great for 12 years, but this year, people have been taking a huge hit. I mean, short of the top 3 to 5 stocks in the stock market, in the S&P, these 3 to 5 tech stocks, one of them, I think, includes Tesla, have really carried the entire stock market. So it's a very stressful place to be, and very unpredictable, and you have zero control. So what's one solution? One solution is something we've been doing for years through Norada Capital at noradacapital.com, offering promissory notes that pay a minimum of 12% per year, but a 12 to 15% rate of return or more. We actually average over 15% payouts.
Okay.
But you can lock in to a 12 to 15% annual rate of return on these promissory notes that pay monthly direct deposit distributions. So it's a very passive investment. It's paying a minimum of 12%, averages over 15%. It's a fixed rate. You get paid every month, direct deposit into your account on the second day of the month. And it could be in a self-directed retirement account of any kind, or it could be, you know, your own personal checkings and savings accounts.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter. But it's a very straightforward, simple investment. It's ultra passive, because once it's created, once it's set up, you just get a monthly, you know, deposit into your bank account every month. And that goes on for the term that you choose, which could be a minimum of 3 years.
Okay.
And you can go for as long as 7 years. So you just lock into that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 year term. And then you just get those distributions every month.
Okay. So you said minimum 3 years for duration up to 7 years. Is there a minimum, funding or minimum investment amount? Is that kind of dependent on the notes that come about?
Yeah, technically we could do a 2-year note, and we could do longer than 7. We just advertise or market 3 to 7, because that's the sweet spot. All of our investors will always ask, can I do a 3-4 or like a 6 or 7? Like that's the range.
Okay, gotcha.
They want to lock in for the longer term predictable income. Others are saying, hey, my kid's going to go to college in 3 years, so I'll just do the 3-year note because I might need the cash to take my son to college. So that's the range, but we could do 2, we could do more.
Okay.
So. To your question, the minimum investment is $50,000. We have done 25,000 for a few people.
Okay.
But our stated minimum is 50,000. There's no cap, there's no upper range. But the way that the tiers break down is 50,000 is 12% per year.
Okay.
$100,000 investment and above is 15% per year. Again, these are all paid monthly. And then investors that come in at 200,000 and above, they still get the 15% per year paid monthly, but they get a bonus 5% interest on the maturity date of the note. So when that note matures, say they have a 4-year term, they get that $200,000 back plus an extra 5% bonus or interest kicker, if you will, on top of that.
Gotcha. Okay. So kind of the low end to high end, 12 to 20% total returns, depending on the amount you put in. And again, for anyone listening out there, maybe you're not, sitting on a bank account with $200,000 just collecting dust, but I might have a self-directed IRA that you might be able to put to good use and invest in this asset class as well. So
I just want to make you mention 20%.
with the
It
bonus,
doesn't,
I know.
yeah, it doesn't actually equate to 20% because it's 15% per year for the
Okay.
term of your note. But when you get that 5%, to figure out your true interest rate, you take 5% and divide it by the number of years of your note. So let's just take a 3-year note, divide 5 by the 3 years. It works
Gotcha.
out to be 1.7. I'm just rounding off.
Sure.
So
Okay. Yes.
your effective rate of return for those 3 years ends up being 16.7% per year.
Okay. So, and for those listening, you can tell which one is better at math between the two of us on this podcast.
No, it's a common mistake, believe me. Because the 5% bonus, you think, oh, that worked out to be like 5% more and it averages
Yeah.
out every year. No, it was actually 5% over the course of that 3 years. So
Gotcha.
you divide it by 3 years.
Gotcha. Or probably on the same way where some of the investment gurus say that, oh, I made a 2000% annual return. Well, yeah, you had a lucky stock pick and within 1 week and you made a 20% return, you analyze that at it comes to 2000 or whatever they're bragging about. So, all
Right.
right. So, as a final note, Marco, any thing that I maybe should have asked you that on the 1% rule, the Narrata capital or the Narrata funding, and if any of my listeners are interested in any of this, is there kind of like a one-stop shop place that they can contact you
A lot of questions. So
at?
final, yeah. So kind of final comment. I always like to say, look, there's, it's all about taking action. There's three kinds of people in the world that this is my theory, philosophy, if you will.
Okay.
There's people who make things happen. There's people who watch things happen, and then there are people who wonder what happened. And you don't want to be in that third category, right?
Exactly.
So it's okay to be in the second. We're in the second category most of the time. But look, when it comes to, your personal finances and investing, you need to be in driving the ship and be in control. You need to be the conductor of your financial life. You might not be doing everything. You'll hire people to do the things for you, but you need to be the conductor. And that means you need to make crap happen. And that means you have to take action. You can listen to the stuff that we talked about today, and it all sounds great. And you should be taking action and investing in real estate and or investing in promissory notes and or whatever else it might be. But look, if you just listen and educate yourself forever and keep listening to your podcast forever, you'll be knowledgeable, but you may not be successful,
Yeah.
right? So you need to take action at some point in time and call, talk to somebody, ask questions, learn and take action, put a plan together and take action. So that's the biggest piece of advice I can give because a lot of people become educated, but they don't achieve their goals. Let's
Sure.
kind of put it that way. Yeah. So that's kind of the biggest parting tips and advice I would give.
Perfect.
As far as reaching my team, NaratareelEstate.com and NarataCapital.com are the two websites where you can get tons and tons and tons of free information and be able to contact my team and I.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thanks for writing that, and I'll have it on the show notes. So, Marco, thanks again. It's been great to catch up, and hope the heat wave in California breaks here soon or breaks by the next time we talk.
Yeah, no, I hope so too. But John, I appreciate your time. You keep up the good work with your great show, and thank you for bringing up me on again.
You
Appreciate
bet.
it.
Thanks. Thanks again, Marco.
Take care.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to share, rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. For more updates, check out www.wealthandfreedomnexus.com. Remember, nothing on this show should be considered tax, legal, investment, or professional advice. This show is produced solely for educational and informational purposes. Please consult an appropriate and licensed tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for specific advice for your situation. For distribution or publication rights or media interviews, please contact the host.